From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
These are the people who lop off heads of Christians and other people who don't agree with them. I mean, they're barbaric. And so the question for the free world is, do we want to allow these folks to continue to move on this reign of terror in this world?
They have to go through criminal background checks. You can count on it that it doesn't matter that, you know, the country's in chaos. Until you jump through all these hoops, they're not coming. It's not like the people who are fleeing Syria right now are going to get here anytime soon. It's years.
The city wants to use monies that would otherwise be contributed to these funds for other services. That's the very rationale for cutting pension benefits that this court rejected earlier this year.
The consequences to the fund of the act being upheld or struck down could not be more stark. With it allowed to stand, the fund will no longer be on this inevitable path to insolvency. It will have guarantees and enforcement mechanisms that will ensure the payment of the promised benefits.
Some of the sounds of the week that was in Illinois state politics and government. Immigrants in Illinois, front and center. They weren't even on the radar a week ago. And Chicago, City of Chicago pension case goes before the state's high court. We'll talk about those things and other happenings in state government on this week's State Week. I'm Bill Wheelhouse. Our panel this week, Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, Amanda Venicky, State House Bureau Chief for WUIS and Illinois Public Radio, and joining us is Kurt Erickson, soon-to-be-departing State Capitol Bureau Chief for Lee Enterprises, which includes newspapers in Bloomington, Decatur, Carbondale, and the Quad Cities, among others. After 19 years, we have to say goodbye, Kurt, but we're going to make you do the show first.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Through our tears.
We'll start with Chicago pensions. That was a case before the Illinois Supreme Court this week. I know, Amanda, you were sitting watching those arguments take place. So what's the case in this instance?
Well, so this is interesting, even if you don't live in Chicago, for a couple of reasons. First of all, that's because a lot of municipalities are struggling with pension payments, particularly for police and firefighters. And so what clues will this provide for them as they potentially seek to make changes going forward? And secondly, because obviously we had the state pension law that got tossed out by the Supreme Court earlier this year. And then we have the court now taking up this municipal version. So are they the same? Are they different? And just kind of what lessons are to be had from that? The Chicago pension law passed in 2014 did have a lot of similarities to the statewide massive overhaul that applied to state workers, teachers, and university employees, such as, you know, you, Charlie, and myself, frankly. But what it did, so it increased the retirement age, and there was a reduction in payouts to retirees. For example, the city's attorneys tried to argue that, in fact, that isn't a diminishment of benefits and therefore doesn't breach the constitutional clause that says pension benefits shall not be diminished or impaired. They said that's because without this, the funds are going to go insolvent in, say, a decade. And that because of that, what they're really doing is saving the pensions. So this should be determined as a net benefit. And what's interesting and also different about this is that you had negotiations with many of the unions on this one. So some 30 or so unions members would be affected by this, and nearly, or more than, in fact, two dozen of them signed on for their membership and said that they'd agreed to it. And further, the pension funds themselves agreed with this argument about preventing insolvency. You had, however, again, that handful of unions or other workers that said, no, we don't want this to happen. This is basically a redo of the state pension case. It is a diminishment of benefits, and you cannot take them away. So
I've got an elementary question related to this, Charlie. Mm-hmm. I'm going to throw it to you. This is a municipal case. It's not a state case. It involves a locality. How does the state constitution's stance on diminishment of benefits apply to a municipality?
The pension clause in the Constitution applies to all governments. It doesn't matter whether it's state or local. And it says it's the contractual relationship benefit in any public employee or membership in any public employee retirement system is a contractual relationship that cannot be diminished or impaired. And as a matter of fact, one of the moving forces behind placing that language in the Constitution at the Constitutional Convention 45 years ago was a concern among police and firefighter associations that were localities given home rule powers, which was another big issue. One of the first things mayors would do, particularly the mayor of Chicago, when the finances got tight, was to arbitrarily cut benefits to pensioners. And so they wanted this ironclad language in the Constitution so that when local governments, again, principally the focus was on the city of Chicago, got home rule powers, the ability to manage many of their own affairs without having to come to the legislature for permission, that they would not be able to reduce pension benefits as a way to save money.
Amanda, was there any line of questioning from justices in the case that gave you any feeling or lead on what anybody was thinking?
You know, you always, of course, want to add the caveat that just because justices have questions, you shouldn't take that as that's how their opinion will be decided. But yes, it definitely seemed as if questions were directed to the city and to the attorneys representing the pension funds, basically those who want the law to stand. They were the ones that were pressed harder, and those saying, nope, this breaks the pension clause, they were let off easy.
Well, in my mind, it's pretty clear how this one is going to go after the decision earlier this year regarding the retirement systems for which the state is responsible. And the notion that, well, some union signed on, I think that's pretty irrelevant in the sense that the Constitution doesn't say whatever pension benefits that you accrue because you belong to a union can't be diminished or impaired. And so, for example, there are people who are covered by this language who don't belong to unions. And so a union can't say, well, we agree to cut your benefits, because they don't speak for those people.
Moving on to another topic, we heard an audio at the beginning of the show. We heard a congressman talking in there saying because of the risk of terrorism, essentially, that Illinois needs to put a pause on allowing Syrian refugees. I think there have been maybe 150 over the course of the last 5 years, something like that. But the governor came out this week and announced that there was a temporary pause, Amanda.
Yeah, and the question is, does the governor even have the authority to do that? We've seen lots of reporting trying to discover what that is, because, of course, Bruce Rauner is not alone. Many other, particularly Republican governors throughout the United States, have made a same declaration. But what does that mean? The administration hasn't really been all that detailed. They said that they're looking into any sort of legal recourse they could have, but has not said emphatically either way, okay, what would happen to those coming, you know, down the pike in terms of refugee status, because it does take, you know, years to come in. What would the administration do to keep refugees out of the state of Illinois? And further, the city of Chicago had said, in the city council voted already, it's a sanctuary city. They kind of reiterated that, and in what some people say is really more of a symbolic vote, but nonetheless said, no, we do believe that refugees should be allowed in. In fact, we welcome them here within the city.
Yeah, Rauner's decision kind of echoed a what at that point was a Republican call, and a lot of the you know, Republican congressmen in Washington were sort of saying the same thing, maybe a little bit harsher than Rauner's release. Only statement on the idea was pretty measured, but as we have seen in Washington this last week, there have been Democrats who've joined in with this proposal to have them have the refugees, you know, more seriously vetted and checked off, which opponents say will set back efforts to find them sanctuaries for years.
Yeah, and it strikes me that it's a little bit of pandering to the fear that's out there, and it's, I would say, it borders on being irrational and illogical. You think about what is the threat level posed by the fact that maybe 2 years from now, somebody who is now has fled Syria and is waiting in a refugee camp and is going through all this vetting and is being more intensely screened than anybody else who would want to come to this country is going to come to Illinois and do some terrorist activity. I would argue that it's more likely that on my way home tonight I get run into by a drunk driver than it is that some Syrian is going to pull off a terrorist attack. And if you look back at the terrorist attacks, the mass attacks that we've had since the 9/11 attacks, it's been homegrown people that are doing it. As a matter of fact, there's a couple brothers that are going to plead guilty in next month in federal court to basically trying to help the Islamic State, and they are homegrown. They're a couple young men who grew up in Aurora, U.S. citizens. One was in the National Guard, and they were going to shoot up the armory in Joliet. And they didn't come here from Syria. And that's more of a danger, I think, the people who are here and for whatever reason are disaffected or disgruntled or mentally ill.
You know, this is also, I think, as we've talked about, it's a matter of, for some, national security, but it's also, of course, very much political at this time. And we're seeing that play out in congressional races, in the U.S. Senate race. We've had this week, actually, a third Democrat enter, State Senator Napoleon Harris has come into that race. And when he was asked about it at his press conference where he declared his candidacy, it was reported that he didn't even know what the issue was and hadn't heard Governor Rauner's statements. The other two Democrats, Tammy Duckworth, a congresswoman, did not vote for the SAFE Act that passed through the U.S. House that makes some changes, makes it a lot stricter to take in Syrian refugees.
She's not in the Senate.
Yeah, she wants to be. And so that is something that the current senator, who she wants to take, Republican Mark Kirk, really blasted her for in saying that it is putting, you know, the nation at risk. And then the other Democratic U.S. Senate candidate, Andrea Zopp, also has said, and she put the blame on, you know, Governor Bruce Rauner and basically said that this is politics on his behalf. So a whole lot of politics really surrounding this humanitarian and security issue.
Yeah, I believe there are only two Democratic members of the House from Illinois who voted for this harsh anti-immigrant law. One was Representative Dan Lipinski from Chicago, who's basically, I would say, he's maybe the most conservative Democrat from Illinois in the House. And the other was Sherry Bustos, a congresswoman from the Quad Cities in her second term, who is kind of a Republican target.
Is there any kind of vote you see trickling down to the Illinois legislature that they could end up taking on this issue as we head into an election year?
Yeah, I've been kind of tracking the bill introductions. I'm waiting for that. You know, I assume it would come from a Rauner ally or, you know, one of the more conservative members of the House. The clock is ticking. It's just a matter of when. And who knows? I mean, it probably will never get debated.
And we're on the opposite side. I could also see some sort of resolution coming from a more, you know, liberal leaning or somebody who sympathizes with refugees saying a resolution that Illinois supports their coming in, but not anything that would necessarily have the effect of law behind it, just a resolution in support.
Yeah, and one of the questions is, what can a governor of a state do? Legally, governors have no power to close their borders to these immigrants. That's a federal issue. On the other hand, the federal government provides money to states to help people coming to this country assimilate into the new life, transition money. Some of it is for social services. Some of it is for educational services, housing, those kinds of things. Usually it's administered, the state gets the money, hires nonprofit groups to actually provide the services. So I suppose a state could sit on the money, or you could encourage anti-immigrant groups to have rallies to, burn crosses on the lawns of Muslim families, that kind of nonsense. As I said, the irrationality of it is just amazing in my mind. And let me offer as kind of a contrasting irony of the mass murders, the atrocities that we've seen in this country, school kids on the East Coast, community college people on the West Coast, theater goers in Colorado. Those were perpetrated by people who were mentally ill. And in my mind, the scary thing is the Sun-Times did a report, an investigation a few days ago, looking at people who have had their firearm owner's identification card revoked because of mental illness. Patients who show violent, suicidal, threatening, or assaultive behavior is the way the statute reads. And the state police have invalidated more than 50,000 of these firearm owners' identification cards. Well, the law also says the state police are supposed to get those firearms back. If I lose my card because I'm mentally unstable, I'm supposed to surrender my card and surrender whatever weapons I have, and the police are authorized to come and get them. Well, through, I guess it would be mid-August, would be 8 months of this year, only 7 firearms have been recovered. Only 14 were recovered in all of 2014, according to the Sun-Times and state records. So if you're concerned about what kind of situation might develop in which there's a mass murder as occurred in these terrorist attacks overseas, I would be more worried about some person who is mentally deranged and has a firearm and goes off half-cocked. I think the possibility of that happening is a lot greater than some poor soul fleeing the terror in Syria and having the ranks of those folks infiltrated by some ISIS member who 2 years from now might do something in Illinois.
One point I have, and any of you can feel free to take this on, a lot, the argument frequently is, well, one person gets through that commits that crime. I think the behavior we're seeing related to this, it does not bode well for some of the criminal justice reform that they keep talking about, because I think it, when it comes down to it, it shows that by and large, lawmakers will be quite skittish when it comes to reducing prison sentences and letting people out of prison earlier than they already do, based on the same principle.
Yeah, I mean, the governor wants to reduce the number of prisoners in the overcrowded Illinois Department of Corrections by 25% over the next decade. And so they are working on legislation that would, you know, reduce penalties for crimes that maybe 10 years ago or 20 years ago people wanted heavy fines or heavy penalties for. And it's really tough to do that. And so we've seen kind of a shift in recent years to, the get tough on crime Republicans are saying, yeah, you know, that was a bad policy. We really can't sustain these all these prisoners. We're paying too much money for that. And it doesn't work because people are getting out of prison and going right back. So we saw this shift, but, now we could see this get tough on crime feel come back into vogue and derail
and
some of this.
It's played out, like in the Kentucky governor's race, I think that was an issue. So you're seeing both sides of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I thought it was interesting the way this, as Kurt said, the way this has evolved. And part of it is the kind of the coming together of two very dissimilar groups of people with different perspectives on this. One is the, like the bleeding heart liberals, the do-gooders who want to reform people and give them an opportunity to go straight. And from about the mid-70s on, their voices had been outweighed by get tough on people, lock them up and throw the key away. But now some of those hardliners are also fiscal conservatives are looking at it and saying, hey, we're spending a ton of money on this. What was a $200 million Department of Corrections budget back 30 years ago, 35 years ago, now it's like $1.3 billion. Our prisons are more crowded than we started doing this. So it's the, as I say, the bleeding hearts plus the hardline fiscal conservatives who've come together and said there's got to be a better way to do this.
Kurt, you reported this week that a group that's trying to get a special commission that would draw legislative maps and take it out of the hands of the legislature seems to be chugging along well, in their view, towards getting enough signatures for a constitutional amendment next year. Can you update us there?
Yeah, to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot through a citizen initiative, you have to collect about 290,000 valid signatures from registered voters, and it's really hard to do. The last time we went around was during the 2014 election, and both of the big citizen initiatives failed. One was a redistricting one like this one, and the other was the term limits. Am I correct? Yeah, remembering mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. so long ago. They both failed for, you know, technical reasons and tossing out
They didn't make it to the ballot.
They didn't make it to the ballot. So this group, the redistricting group, the Independent Maps Commission, is surpassed the 400,000 mark this week. And so they want to have more than 290 when they go to submit them. Their goal is to get 600,000 signatures, and so, you know, to basically secure that, you know, you can't throw the math wouldn't work that you could throw out more than half of the ones that they need. So, you know, they're pretty pleased with where they're at this point.
Now, does their effort at this time?
The problem last time around was that they didn't have enough valid signatures.
Part of the problem.
And it was also challenged in court. And the court opinion said that this does not fit within the very narrow window of what the Constitution allows in terms of citizens' initiatives to amend the legislative article. And the problem was that the prior plan included a ban on people involved in the new redistricting process running for a statewide office for something like 10 years. And the Cook County Circuit Judge said that ban, in effect, changes the requirements to be eligible to run for these offices, and therefore you're amending that section of the Constitution that sets out the requirements, and this goes outside the scope. But she also observed that redistricting per se is fair game for a citizens' initiative because, as a matter of fact, during the debate at the convention, when someone inquired, well, what might this entail, the citizens' initiative, redistricting was acknowledged as being, well, this is kind of what we had in mind.
So, Charlie, based on what you just said, should this get the requisite signatures, you feel this would stand a better chance of a technical challenge?
Oh, sure. And obviously I'm not a lawyer, I'm not on the Supreme Court, but I would be pretty confident that if they have 600,000 signatures, it's going to be impossible to invalidate, as Kurt said, half of them. It'll be challenged in court, and I have to believe that based on the rulings to date, based on the kind of the roadmap laid out at the circuit court level, it stands a very good chance of being approved. I mean, we've only had one citizen's initiative in all the time that the Constitution, the new Constitution, has been in effect, and that was the cutback amendment in 1980.
Certainly, and this is not scientific data, but the anecdotal experience I've seen when I've seen people being asked to sign the petition for this particular cause, there seems to be more excitement from the potential petition signers than I see on a lot of things.
You know, I think that part of it. Redistricting has been something that's like, wait, what? What does that even mean? It's not as if that term is all that great of one, and yet it has caught on. I mean, presumably the last time around and all of the news it made, people are coming to an understanding further. It's been in the news in other states, and there was an issue before the U.S. Supreme Court regarding redistricting. I'm guessing that term limits would be met with just as much of a appetite from voters that kind of we're seeing it play out all sorts of places in the presidential election and so on. Just this kind of distaste for politicians and a belief that politicians have in many ways given them good reason to have that the system is set up for elected officials' own benefit versus that of the public. And this is one of those. So I think that that's presumably, you know, part of why they've got the argument down pat further. When I've seen people passing these around and asking for signatures, they don't necessarily say redistricting. They pull people in. Hey, you want to talk about how to make the government more fair? That's the phraseology.
Stop that gerrymandering.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Well, and to me, I think it shows a sophistication on voters' parts that term limits is maybe better understood and, you know, more of a catchphrase and people are all for it. But they're now seeing that term limits really don't mean anything if you don't change the way the districts are drawn in the first place. So if you have term limits and you term limit out a MOPE from a gerrymandered district, the likely replacement is going to be another MOPE.
Oh. And there isn't a term limits initiative being passed around this time around.
Well, and that's because it's pretty clear that does not fit within the narrow constitutional window. That one was thrown out by the court two years ago. And that was the second time that has been invalidated on constitutional grounds, that it doesn't meet the initiative as spelled out in the Constitution.
After nearly 20 years in the Illinois State Capitol, Kurt Erickson, who's been with Lee Enterprises, the Bloomington paper, Decatur, Carbondale, and others, he is moving on to cover the Missouri legislature for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. As you reflect on that many years of seniority, was there anything that stuck you out as your favorite moment through covering the Capitol?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that. You know, what's really been remarkable and unremarkable. I mean, I'm sad to leave with school funding still like the kind of in the same position that it's been. It's failing and hurts rural school districts downstate and poor districts in the south suburbs of Chicago. So that's kind of a disappointment. But you know, I really liked some of the conflict and the drama that came around here once in a while with, you know, former state representative Bill Black throwing things in the House chamber and, you know, those kind of fun things. I, you know, remember some of my colleagues getting in a shoving match in the Senate press box. Those things stick out. But, you know, also the policy questions and the laws, you know, I never thought I'd see Illinois approve concealed carry. And they went dragging and kicking after the courts required them to do that. You know, medical marijuana, gay rights, gay marriage, all those things were not even on the radar screen in the mid-1990s when I came here. The one constant common thing has been the budget, and that really drives everything in Springfield. And right now we don't have one, so that's pretty remarkable to be witnessing, and I'm kind of sad to leave without seeing that resolved. I don't think it will be resolved anytime soon.
And we wish you the best of luck. That's our time for this edition of State Week. Thanks to Kurt of Lee Enterprises State Capital Bureau. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.